Former Premier Mossadegh's ruined house is a mute testimony to 3 days of bloody rioting, culminating in a military coup from which the one-time dictator of Iran fled for his life. The Shah, who had fled to Rome, comes home.
The U.S. was involved the 1953 coup that brought the Shah back to power. He made a very strong point of correcting any reference to the Iranian Revolution. My name is Richard Falk. I taught for many years international relations and international law at Princeton University between 1961 and 2001, and have in recent years been teaching at the University of California in Santa Barbara, and also acting on behalf of the United Nations as a special rapporteur on occupied Palestine. Over the years, I've been particularly interested in problems associated with the Middle East, and I became concerned about the situation in Iran at the end of the Vietnam War, because in the early 1970s, it appeared to me that the next country that the United States would have difficulties in was Iran, because there was a very large military presence, there was the CIA connection with the embassy, and there seemed to me to be a rising atmosphere, a rising mood of discontent with the Shah's government.
Former Premier Mossadegh's ruined house is a mute testimony to 3 days of bloody rioting, culminating in a military coup from which the one-time dictator of Iran fled for his life. The Shah, who had fled to Rome, comes home, backed by General Zahedi, military strongman, who engineered his return to power. Iranian oil may again flow westward.
I was familiar with the accusations that the U.S. was involved in the 1953 uprising that brought the 1953 coup that brought the Shah back to power and overthrew a democratically oriented Mossadegh government. I had opposed American policy in Vietnam for some years and had twice visited North Vietnam during the war and met with the North Vietnamese leaders and became convinced that military intervention under the auspices of the United States was both very devastating for the target society that was intervened against, and very detrimental to the healthy development of American society. So I was an opponent of military intervention on both realist and ethical grounds, and that was really the underpinning of my concern about the future of Iran. before he came from Paris to Iran. Actually, it was the last day he was in Paris. And we met him for quite a long time, for maybe 2-3 hours. I was particularly struck by his grasp of some of the political dimensions of the situation. He was inquiring of us what we thought the American response would be. He seemed intelligently interested in whether there would be an attempt to resist the revolutionary process. He made a very strong point of correcting any reference to the Iranian Revolution. He wanted it described as the Islamic Revolution. And he seemed to take a position that was skeptical of nationalism and more receptive to the idea of an Islamic internationalism. He also spoke very critically about the Saudi government and the idea of a dynastic royal family governing a society. He said that he himself was looking forward, as he put it, to resuming the religious life and going back to Qom to live, that he had, again, as he put it, I think these are his exact words, he only entered politics because there was a river of blood between the state and the people. I asked him about the fate of Jews in Iran, and he gave an interesting answer in which he said, as far as the Jews are concerned, they are part of a genuine religion, and if they don't deal too directly with Israel, they are welcome in Iran, and it would, and he added, it would be a tragedy for us if they left. I was asked when I returned by the New York Times to write an article for them on my experience of meeting Ayatollah Khomeini, and I did that, and they gave a very provocative headline to my article, which they never showed me, which read, "Trusting Khomeini." And I got many death threats and other very hostile responses because of mostly because of the headline. The article itself was pretty cautious about saying that one couldn't tell what was going to happen, that in this period that it was unclear whether this kind of very unexpectedly quick revolution could transform itself into a democratic governing process.
Persia. At the turn of the century, a poor agricultural country, rich only in legend and undeveloped natural...
Well, before the revolution, Iran was perceived by the American political leadership as a very important strategic ally. It was important because it provided a base for surveillance directed at the Soviet Union. It was important because it did certain political things that were not feasible for the United States to do directly. For instance, it provided Israel with oil, and it provided South Africa, I believe, with oil. It was generally seen as a very reliable ally, and the Shah was seen as the closest thing the U.S. had to a real friend in the region. Kissinger made the famous statement that the Shah of Iran was the rarest of things, an unconditional ally. And he offered the Shah whatever he wished in terms of military assistance and equipment, and encouraged the Iranian nuclear program, which is, of course, ironic in the present context. The Shah's own memoir is rather ambivalent about the relationship to the United States. On the one hand, he thinks that he antagonized the U.S. through the oil policy. On the other hand, he complains that the U.S. didn't tell him what to do during the early stages of the revolutionary opposition that began in 1978, or early 1978. And the United States was uncertain, tried to intervene at the last stages through NATO. It sent this American general, Heuser, to Tehran, and he found at that stage that even the military was not prepared to act. And so there was no political foundation for protecting the Shah's regime against this unexpected revolutionary movement. We also went to see Ambassador Sullivan while we were in Tehran, and he had been of interest to me because he had been the ambassador in Laos during the Vietnam War and had been a very aggressive diplomat, using the embassy to target parts of Laos. And his appointment to Iran was itself a signal that the U.S. thought Iran was dangerous from the point of view of some future challenge to the Shah. And I had actually testified against his confirmation as ambassador in the United States Senate before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And when we met him in Iran at the height of this revolutionary process, he agreed to talk on the record. And among the things he said was that the embassy had 26 scenarios of what could threaten the Shah's regime, and not one of them looked at the Islamic movement, that there was a feeling that all the dangers to the Shah came either from Marxist left sources or from some kind of internal corruption and internal fighting among the entourage that surrounded the Shah. They thought that the Islamic movement was anti-communist and therefore on the Western American side. And that was consistent with the policies in the Afghanistan war in the 1980s, where they helped the extremist groups, including Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and saw the issues in East-West Soviet-American bipolarity. And anything that was seemed to be anti-communist was good. And anything that was pro-communist or was left in its orientation was automatically perceived to be bad. I think that the expectation still was that Iran would remain a strategic ally. And if you remember, Jimmy Carter spent his first New Year's Eve as a guest of the Shah and made that famous toast about the Shah being an island of stability surrounded by the love of his people. And that toast was very well known by the people in Iran at the time that I was visiting in late 1978. The other thing that was very well known and really goes in the direction opposed to the conspiracy understanding was the degree to which Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor, was a close friend and associate of the Shah's ambassador in Washington, Zahedi, and that Zahedi encouraged Brzezinski to encourage the Shah to be tough on the opposition. A very bloody encounter in Jalle Square was the time when, during, it was 1978, during the Camp David talks between Israel and Palestine, that Carter was heavily involved with. And the only time they interrupted the talks was to call to congratulate the Shah on the bloody encounter on so-called Bloody Friday, I think it's sometimes referred to, where the entries to the square were blocked and the Shah's military used machine gun fire to shoot unarmed demonstrators. I do know that Rockefeller and Kissinger intervened very strongly after the Shah's abdication to plead for his medical attention in the U.S. And there is a great deal of suspicion that they did that not so much because of their love for the Shah, but because they thought it would his admission to the U.S. would precipitate a crisis that would freeze the assets of the banks that had dealt with Iran. And the Rockefeller Bank, Chase Manhattan, was very overcommitted in making loans to Iran. And the Iranian government, very early in the post-revolutionary period, said that it would honor all debts except the one to Chase Manhattan. So they had a very strong interest in provoking a crisis with the United States. And in the eventual settlement, when the hostages were released, the banks were the first to receive reimbursement for their claims. And they not only were paid what the debt was, but they had received interest payments between the time of the revolution and this release of the hostages. So they had a kind of windfall profit in addition to what they were owed. So it worked out very well for the Rockefeller-Kissinger interests. And interestingly, and adding to the conspiracy view, as soon as the deal was made that released the hostages and paid off the banks, Kissinger and Rockefeller completely dropped the Shah. They had no future dealing with him, as far as I know. See, the Chase Manhattan Bank was the only one that had trouble. All the other banks had because the new government was being run economically by some actually Stanford economists who wanted to make smooth relations with the European and American, North American economies. And so they gave assurances that all the obligations of the Shah's period would be respected. And they made an exception because of the closeness of chase to Iran. It's hard to calculate, and probably there isn't a general answer that is satisfactory. There's no question that Israel exercises a great deal of influence on the formation of US policy in the region. To a large extent, there's a convergence of interest between Israel and the United States. They both want stability, openness to the global market. They both don't want any anti-Western movement to gain control over important countries in the region. At the same time, I think that Israel is more concerned with weakening those governments that seem to challenge its legitimacy and pose some kind of security threat. And Iran has been particularly threatening to Israel. My crystal ball is quite cloudy today, and I think people like myself have very limited understanding of the way in which this complex of forces will work out. I think one can say that there are a lot of reasons to believe that this government in Iran will be increasingly challenged from below periodically. At the same time, it's shown a considerable capacity to survive and to adjust to challenges directed at it. The hostility of Israel and to some degree elements in the United States seem at this stage unlikely to produce a military intervention, but it's hard to know how the future will unfold. And if indeed Israel believes or wants the West to believe that Iran has nuclear weapons, it could very well lead to a military confrontation, which would have very serious regional and global impacts. And so I think we have to say that even though the recent developments suggest a fairly stable period in the near future, there are many uncertainties that make it hard to predict the future.